computer audio, camera, we can't hold. Okay, I'm gonna do that. And I share my screen. Share that. And then, oh. Okay. Website.
Giving me the way.
So I passed them all. Applications are due on the 6th. I see a couple of things. In here is record keeping is mentioned as one of the duties. So there was a question on the exam about there's a federal requirement for record keeping. So that's why it's one of your duties on this. You have to have multi-engine commercial transportation rating. It's nice to attend our class. Be very enthusiastic for field work. It's very exciting. Hope that was the motivation for Izzy's talk at the beginning. There are all going to be interviews the week after spring break. They do a ground school. And if we get to it, my second lecture today is about clouds and cloud types, so visual surveillance of the weather. That's going to be about the clouds today. I was going to go over the exam and I guess I got two things related to that I posted on my website. So make it bigger. Yeah. So a lot of people as a class, people didn't, the class, I guess, did not do terrible on the exam. It was about what I would expect, with some A's, well, a lot of people getting B's, but there were some C's and a lot of lower grades. I'm assuming that the lowest grades, maybe you didn't know what to study or didn't study enough. It's not a, let's say this is not a, let's say an easy course. So you need to study. So I got two things I'm going to try to do to help people's grades. One is give a little bit different assignments and try to give you a little bit more assignments to increase your assignment scores. So for this week, for today, I have an assignment with 10 questions that should open up in your Blackboard. So it's like a quiz or an exam or something that's with the, since I've learned how to do this Blackboard Respondus browser. So there's 10 multiple choice questions in there. And it takes me a long time to make these up. So I hope you appreciate the questions. But I put it in there so you can, it's due in a week. It's 10 points, but you can do it twice. So there's two attempts. But it's also very short time. So once you open it up, you have to complete it in, like, I forget what I put, like 6-8 minutes. It's not very long. So you can't go and look up the answers while you're taking the test. So what I expect you to do is take the test. As I said on my thing, take the test. And the test is over, it's kind of like a review of the hard topics from the exam. So take the test. And then go back. And if there's questions that you weren't sure of the answers for, go back and look at them topics, okay? Review that in the lecture, ask me questions, and then you could take it a second time. And then hopefully that time you would have reviewed it, you know all the things, and then you should get all the answers right. Okay, I don't know if anybody's ever done this, so we'll try this. And we'll see how these homeworks go. I'm gonna try to give you some more of them, and if they're kind of low scores, we'll drop one or something like that to keep your exam up. The other thing is that for the people that did poorly on this first exam, I don't promise to do this for the next exam, I probably won't. But for this one, since it's a little bit late and I don't want you to have to drop the craft because of one exam, didn't do well on this one exam. I'll give you another exam on next Tuesday after class, if you can make it. If not, let me know, we can schedule another time. But since we don't have the classroom, we'll have to go over to Clifford Hall or someplace, so we'll do that. And we'll give you another exam, but I wanna kind of design this just for the people that kind of did poorly, where you think you could definitely improve. So try not to just have the whole class. Yeah.
Well, we'll do this, once we get to the second exam, places for only the grader.
Well, I was gonna do that, but I don't want everybody to take it, so I'm gonna make it that this is gonna be your score on the second exam. Okay, so I'm trying to limit it. If you got a decent score, I'm gonna just keep that and go with it. So I'm gonna make it so that it takes this score, and the exam may be slightly harder too. So if you got a pretty decent score, I would just keep that.
What would you say a decent score is?
Well, it's all relative, right?
Like
so
B or greater, or
well, I think the way I designed this class, I think everybody could get a B. Okay, so you know, my thinking is if you got a B or an A, I would keep that. If you know, because the course is not designed for everybody to get an A. But if you kind of have a low C, a B, or something like that, and them other people, this is very poor. Okay, does that make sense?
Kind of a two-part question. For the test, was B like 80 or like 82?
I was gonna just keep like an 80 for B.
And then my second question was, so if you get like, you know, like B's on the exam, and then you know, consistently like 9, 8.5, 9, 10 points on the assignments. Well, how does like the exam grade combined with the assignment grade, like how is that?
Right now they're both graded the same, 50-50.
So if you get like 100, if you get like good grades on that individual, I'll have a couple.
Yeah, I mean, so you know, typically when I was thinking of this, usually the assignments are usually easier than the exams, but you could, I guess your assignments have been not necessarily the easiest so far. So I'm hoping to get you some, what I'm thinking are gonna be a little bit easier, at least in terms of the grading. So, you know, for someone that gets an A in a class, they would get, let's say, an 88 on the exams, and a 92 on the assignment. If you get a B, you'll get a 82 on the exact on the assignments and a 78 on the exams.
And you're gonna keep 88%.
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes what I do is if you're close, you know, if it's 79.6, might kick them people up a little bit. But so pretty much, you know, if you gotta, you know, so and like I'm gonna try to get some of these assignments a little bit more of them. Try to give you one every day for a while. And hopefully they won't be quite as challenging in terms of the grades. Does that make sense? So, but there were quite a few people that got B's. Like I said, this class is not really designed so that everybody gets an A or even, you know, can get an A, but if you work hard, I think you can get a B. That's the way I try to design it. But there's nothing wrong with C's and stuff either. So, you know, but if you're in the low D areas, that's where it's a concern. That makes sense. So, okay, so that if you we'll just come after class and so study hard. And so I guess I will ask you first. And then I'll open up the exams, but if you remember any questions that confused you or any topics from the exam that you want to ask me and clarify, because I got the assignment here, it's going to kind of review this. And I think the hardest topic was the last part, the aerosols, nucleation, water vapor. That's where all the hard questions that people had trouble with were on. And I'm trying to have the next exam also cover that material. So I really want you to learn the material on that. So this is not like, so we'll try to get some more questions. And the other thing is, please try to think of questions. Like if you're taking notes, the best way to take notes, I think, is to write down questions. You know, what's he going to ask about this topic? So any general questions about aerosols?
So aerosols, like asking a question that I have in about like the last test.
Yeah.
Okay. Pure water drop exists. When does that happen?
So you have to remember from our assignment, from the lecture, there's the science definition of pure water. So this pure is the key to that question. Okay. So so pure water is water with nothing else. Okay. And we try, so if you have an aerosol particle and the water condenses onto that, it either stays as a solid particle or it dissolves into that, and then the water is not pure anymore. Okay, so another way to ask that question would be, can you form water droplets without a Krall condensation nuclei or without an aerosol?
Yes.
How? That's okay. Is that water or is that ice? So now remember, we have heterogeneous and homogeneous ice nucleus. That's forming ice. And also this is in the atmosphere. Okay, so you don't get confused between water and ice.
So it's impossible to have pure water?
Yeah.
Because I didn't tell you this, but I told you that, you know, we form them on aerosol particles. But the supersaturation with respect to water that you would need to form it is like 400%.
Really?
It's huge. So that was a hard question because I guess, you know, I never explicitly covered that. But it was inferred from the idea of having CCN, and they always form on CCN to do that.
Do dissolved gases count against it being pure, or gases not part of that definition?
Dissolved gases. I guess I would count that too, because you could. You can form like sulfuric acid in the water droplets if you got a lot of SO2 gas. So, but it becomes a bit of a quandary, but I think that would also exclude the possibility of pure water. Because the gases like sulfur dioxide could dissolve in the droplets to give you a sulfuric acid particle, where that wouldn't really form in ice.
Three main things that
we talked about. Yeah, so we talk about three types of aerosols. There's the total aerosols, or all the condensation nuclei aerosols. So that's what I call total, all the particles larger than 10 nanometers. So condensation nuclei are the big concentration. There's tens of thousands or tens of thousands of these per cubic centimeter. So then a subset or smaller fraction of that are the Crowell condensation nuclei, which are the nuclei that form the water droplets, that the water droplets form on. Okay, so that's a subsection that could be in the hundreds. Okay, and then a subsection of that, 100 per cubic centimeter, and then a subsection of that, it's not really a subsection, a CCN is a subsection of all of them, but the ice nuclei are part of. It's not necessarily CCN, but they're a subsection of the total. But they are the least abundant. And they are, you know, less than one per cubic centimeter a lot of times. So very low concentrations.
And is that concentration difference dependent on their size? Like, are all condensation nuclei greater than 10? And all condensation nuclei are this much greater than 10, and ice nuclei are greater than that in size?
Not necessarily in size, because a lot of times the silver iodine particles that we get from the flares are only 10 to 20 nanometers. They're only, they can be small in terms of silver iodine, 0.02, 0.03. However, some of them can be big. The bacteria particles that make good ice nuclei are typically on the order on an accumulation. They're in the coarse mode. They're super micron sized particles. So the ice nuclei, in terms of the size, can really span big and small. Likewise, the CCN can span the whole size range. However, there's also questions about the Crowell condensation nuclei. It helps to have a big particle for that because of the curvature effect. So the CCN helps to be bigger. And there's not a lot of big CCN, except for maybe sea salt, for example. You have bubble burst and have sea salt. That gives you big CCN. But the big CCN only really occurred next to the ocean surface or near the ocean lower atmosphere.
So that's why if we can put in large CCN, large hygroscopic particles, there's not many of them except near the ocean. The ice deep dry, the size doesn't matter, it's the number, because you want to have a lot of ice particles. And you actually write them small. Because if they're small, then you don't need to put out as much mass of the particle. So it's really the concentration, and we can talk in concentrations, but it's really the number for when the modification applications are important. That's why I don't talk so much in terms of mass or volume or area of the particles. But the size is important because of how long they stay in the atmosphere and because just general knowing where they come from, the sources and sinks are by size.
This is just a question I have a concern. One about who is a weather modification license issued to?
Yeah, so the licenses are issued to people. So think of your pilot's license. So they, to innovate your people, permits are issued to organizations.
But I'm assuming like every single pilot in the weather modification program doesn't have a license.
No. They don't, but it depends on the state requirements. Okay, so the North Dakota does not require a license, but North Dakota requires a permit. Okay, but some states can require a license and you can get licenses.
So then, say, like the weather modification permit is the basic part of that they're doing causing in like Oregon or something. Would then each of their pilots have to like get a license in Oregon?
Or? Not unless the state requires it. But typically they are required to get permits. A lot of times it's more of a permanent requirement. But the idea is you want to know the difference.
So they would never issue like a license to like weather modification?
No. They issue licenses to individuals. You can get them. And there can be individual operator licenses too that different organizations can give. But the licenses are to individuals, like a driver's license.
I guess that's thinking more like a business license.
Yeah, they're not business licenses. They get permits, and the permits are per, well, there's the specifications in the permits, but they can only be permitted in North Dakota. And because it's a state requirement. We can't see it in Minnesota because there's no method to get a license or a permit. So it's not that.
You know, like a state that does require everyone to get a permit?
Well, North Dakota requires the operator to have a permit.
But not a license.
But not a license. I think so, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I know you can get that. There are such a things that some people have. So,
on that topic, are there states that just don't do weather mod like Minnesota? Like, are they more common than states that do have weather mod?
Yeah, like Minnesota. It's not that they prohibit it in statute, but they don't have any mechanisms to allow it. So that becomes, you know, the companies then don't have a mechanism so that they can do it. But I think the majority of the states are kind of like that. It's the Western states that have operations that have a process in place. So they just don't set up the process. And because like Montana, that's why they can't see the process. They got to push to have Montana create a process where you could see. and do weather modification in Montana. But they need the legal infrastructure set up for that. So other questions? You guys hit most of the questions that were hard. Yes.
Oh, I have a question about the unintentional consequences and the difference between scientists knowing about the effects of local stuff.
Local versus global.
Yeah, can you take that question and state it in a different way?
Yeah, so so the idea is what's easier to measure or quantify in one sense, because scientists want to measure and quantify. So if we have to measure precipitation, for example, or temperature changes, it's much easier to quantify and measure them locally than it is globally. Okay, so we know a lot more about changes that happen locally than we do globally. Because any global change has to be a huge average over time and space. Okay, so for example, they did temperatures. It's much easier to measure the temperature change over a city than it is the entire planet. So we talked about one of the questions that was difficult is urban effects. So there are temperature effects that change over the cities. So we can measure them and quantify them, temperature and precipitation changes. So it's temperature changes that we know over the cities, not temperature and winds, it's just temperature. But we could do that because we can have a shorter time period and less measurements to quantify that. So we can actually measure global temperature changes, but we need a huge lot more measurements than what we're making to actually measure a couple tenths of a degree change per decade, which is what global warming predicts. So it's and that's why it's a kind of scientist know or measure.
So do you think that they only like are certain about the changes on a local scale, but they don't, those aren't the ones that I publicize, but they use like the numbers, like if we don't reduce our carbon emissions, like the average sea level temperature is gonna rise by 5 degrees in the next 30 years. Like those are the ones we hear about, but those ones are just, they're not as sure about those as the local ones, but those are the ones that we all hear about
because
they can be generalized.
Well, they're more, in some sense, they're more important. But there's models that we have to extrapolate because you're talking also out to 20, 30 years from now. Okay. The models are actually more accurate and better predictors. Because it's more of a boundary problem than a prediction. We don't have to take what we have now and predict the future. So you hear about them, but it's known them numbers, them ranges of numbers are more uncertain. And it also depends, them type of predictions really depend upon emissions and scenarios of what's going to happen. You know, how much CO2 is going to be emitted, for example. So where, you know, we don't know, we can't quantify that because it hasn't happened yet. Also, you don't have the temperature records even don't go back that far. So it's easier to see something like carbon dioxide. We know that's increasing.
because we can quantify and measure that. Because it's well mixed in the atmosphere, it stays a long time. But the consequences of a temperature change are much harder to measure because it's on the order of a degree. Does that make sense? I'm trying to. It's not necessarily what you hear about so much. And if you think about this too, think very localized, right? I mean, you could change the humidity in the room very easily. You could change the temperature in a room or an area very easily. We could quantify that change, right? And you could turn up the thermostat. So if you think about it very hyper-local, you can change the humidity, temperature very easily. You can very quantify that change or measure. Can I answer your question?
Yeah, I have another question. So you mentioned the urban questions. So what's the difference between wind and air roughness?
Oh, the roughness is the it's a surface roughness. So think of that like a piece of paper can be smooth, or you can have a sandpaper that's very rough. So if you have a very smooth surface, that'd be like a lake. A rough surface is when you have a lot of trees and a lot of buildings.
The question, what do you see in urban areas, difference in temperature, wind? How is wind different than, how is wind different than urban areas?
The roughness can affect the winds, but to what extent too? I mean, it doesn't, and you can have aerodynamic roughness outside of the cities too, right? Trees and other things. But we, it's not, and the other thing is some of that is, maybe I should set that in that, like mean winds would be better as opposed to, a wind that ran right up against the building. It should really be maybe mean winds or mean temperatures averaged over, over hours, not necessarily right next to a building or right next to a so the average temperature changes over the whole city. Well, not necessarily the winds do. And it changes vertically too. I'll try to rephrase that. Maybe that kind of got babbled in on that question.
So there's a question about if the city of North Dakota would affect weather in Ohio. There's like likely, probably, or very unlikely.
Yeah, so it's very unlikely because of the distance.
Okay.
So we talked about like aerosols, they fall, and the effects are right near the clouds, right? So if you're seeing something in North Dakota, you're seeing in the cloud, you don't have, the particles will fall. They won't live long enough to get to their long locations.
We just talked about how like there's one out on the West Coast where residents of one state, they can run them, then like California also pays for it because there's the effects of it.
So the effects are because of the, you get snow in Colorado or Wyoming, for example. We didn't talk in detail about it, but
probably the same amount of part physically that you're distance-wise.
Yeah. But that's the effect is that you get more water in the rivers, but you don't affect the weather. Okay. So you don't affect the precipitation in California, but it's benefit because California pulls water out of Colorado River.
Yep. So like the transfer mass.
Yeah. So it's a water transfer. The other thing is no, the Missouri doesn't venture to Ohio. So you can't, you can't.
Yeah, I just know we talked a lot about like all of the ethical concerns about like what if modification going where it shouldn't, where they weren't supposed to.
So that's the other thing. I mean, that's the idea of the question is it still has to be downwind on that day. So you can have some to like the next county, but really not too many states away or to another country, you know, because the aerosols mix up and they fall and the humidity changes back. So the effects are not global. They're not even regional. They're really on a county, but you don't have a wall right at the county line.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's about the degree, you know. So and it didn't say impossible. So it should be highly unlikely. So that's why scientists, we never talk impossible, but it's not a very likely thing. So
it probably does have some effect just because you're moving it even a minuscule amount of water from the atmosphere, but just because it's so little that we could possibly measure it, it wouldn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the humidity comes back and it's really not going to affect another storm because that storm's going to have plenty of humidity, plenty of aerosols, so that's why you can't, highly unlikely that it will have some effects, but can't really say anything is, overly doesn't have an effect, but it's about the degree. So, so the other ones are on a couple of the pirate ones that besides the aerosol ones are, they don't on the North Dakota project, sorry, they don't have King Air 200s, just the C90s. The number of flight hours, per year kind of, is what I was thinking of for that question is it goes down over time because there's been less counties and some ways to get more efficient at doing it. So unfortunately, you don't have as many hours that people fly in the project now compared to 10 years ago or 15. So, and that was one of the charts that is the show up. So then my odd questions. So anyway, go and see if you get 100% on the assignment to review this. And we keep asking all these questions. I think that's the thing. And because, you have to, one of the things it says on here is you're gonna represent the project to the public. So if someone comes out there and asks you these questions, at least don't say the wrong answers. You can say, I don't know, but don't sound confidently and said, yeah, this seeding project is giving rain to the entire United States.
I'd be very confident in that answer. Okay, so, you know, it's okay to say you don't know or to give your best explanation and why that is. So, and try to understand why we think these things in terms of an understanding underneath it. So, okay, so you should be able to do the other exam questions that were the assignment that's due in a week. Hopefully it works out that you have two attempts on it.
I saw that assignment's 100 points right now. Is that going to stay that way? Right?
Well, I suppose I shouldn't do that. It should be 10 points like the other ones. I'll change that to make it equal weights to the other ones. Good catch. I just meant to make it weighted the same. I mean, I can make the points be the same thing and just weight it differently, but it's basically meant to be counted as the same as any assignment. So 10 questions, if you want to say 1 point a question, you get 10 points, or you get 100 points and I weighted 10%. So. Not until you're done with the assignment.
No, for the old test.
Yeah, I will, but there's a few people that need to take it, and then I'm going to wait until after next Tuesday if some people make up for it. So you will see it before the next exam. So I'll let you see the questions and the answers.
In the past, you told us to talk to the TA about my pop stars if they have questions. But there's a couple that like I just don't understand something, like I can't find it in the PowerPoint.
Yeah, you can talk to me if you got some questions too. So the best thing is after class, if that works for you, we can talk about the answers. I can tell you the answers for the homework. Kind of comfortable giving people more points because I don't know how the other class is graded, but I can definitely tell you the answers. And if after class doesn't work for office hours, just email me and we can make some other arrangements. Before class works well too. So, but we can make some other arrangements, particularly Monday and Wednesday. But I'm not always available. But look at my online schedule. Let's see. If that doesn't work, just email me, particularly with a time or two that works for you. But please ask me questions, because the whole idea here is that I want you to learn the material. And maybe it's a hard class, and you know, if you get a B, you probably learn a lot of materials, a lot of stuff. So. Okay, I'll finish with the exam. Sorry. So apply for the North Dakota project for the internship. It's always a good experience to go through the interviews. Even if you don't get it. So, okay. I need to talk to you about ice crystal growth. And I got a couple relatively short slides here of some pictures, and if I had more time, I would put in my favorite chain aggregate ice crystals that we're studying with one of my graduate students right now. These are chains of kind of like these are crates here. We have chains of these crates that are kind of linear, and we want to know how they form in the atmosphere. And then these are columns, but
But there's a whole classification of these. So scientists go through and like biologists and other people, we classify the crystals. And my students have been flying around on the airplane for 8 hours a day. And they don't look outside and look at the instruments. They look at all these ice crystals and see when they see different ones. So there's a bunch of different crasses to these. They can form different readers, big varieties. I won't ask you any classification questions like to identify them. Our graduate students, we look at these and people have different classifications of the same crystals. So, but the one thing that you should know is that the different habits, classifications, that the habits are of what forms, be it a column, a plate, they form at different temperatures. And also vapor supply, humidity, how much water vapor is in the air. So think now, what's the question to this? You know, something about temperature and habits. Does vapor pressure make a difference? So these are the things that you really need to understand. And there's a bunch of these in terms of what they do. So the particular temperatures, for example, that these columns can form. A lot of times it's minus 15 is a dendrite growth region. These stalwart ones are dendrites here. Put it here. But yeah, you had a question.
So are the columns or like dendrites, those are the different classifications?
The different classifications.
What's a habit?
So a habit is a type, is a classification of the crystal. So if you can think of crystal habits and crystal classifications are kind of the same.
So like the dendrites and columns would also be like each one of those is a habit.
Yeah. So it's like a class of airplanes. You have jet airplanes, you have turboprops. So it's a type of crystal. A lot of times it's the types or the habits are related to the shape. But it's really fundamentally related to the growth. How is it going to grow from the vapor phase? So they got particular growth regimes that are dominant. So the things to remember is they really grow differently in these different temperature humidities, but the clouds are very turbulent, so they can get mixed up. So as they move from different vapor and temperature regimes, they can grow differently. But they also are the fundamentally one single entity that will grow. If you put them at this temperature, at this humidity, and you wrap it like that, you can just grow a single type of crystal. And that's what happens in the atmosphere. The problem is that they all mix, they rise, they change in the clouds. Okay, so the question there is, you know, what determines the habit or the type of crystal you get? Temperature and humidity. We go back to the one equation that we talked about. I guess we have one equation in this class, Krapf-Rahn, which talks about how temperature pressure is related to the type of water, ice. But really, it's the vapor pressure and equilibrium And then again with pure plain water. So that's what the crapper on Crossbond is related to. It's a pure water droplet that's plain surface. Parallel, plain or parallel surface. But now we're talking about ice or frozen water. And the water is held more securely. Okay, so think of these water molecules. If they're in the ice phase, they don't want to go away. Okay, so so the vapor that's in equilibrium with that is less. So there's less vapor over the ice surface than over the water surface. Because think of the water escaping from the water droplet. You put more water into the air than from an ice particle. So that's so there's a question there, right? You can think of some type of question related to water and ice vapor equilibrium amounts. There's different growth rates, because if there's high water vapor near a droplet and there's low water vapor near the ice crystal, so this is my water droplet, this is my ice crystal, the water is going to vapor in the gas phase is going to diffuse from the droplet to the ice. Okay, and so if it hits this ice particle, it's going to grow. It's going to take up that diffused water vapor. So this is very important for weather modification and for crowds. Once you get ice and water to form, the ice will grow even at the expense of the water. Okay, this is why we like to have a lot of ice in the ground. Form the ice, it grows, it gets big, you make precipitation. It can fall, and then if it's warm enough, it will melt and you get rain. So there's a, so ice crystals will grow rapidly. Water droplets can evaporate.
Going back to the,
yeah,
the water vapor will go on to the ice crystal. Is that the Bergeron ice crystal growth process?
No.
Okay.
This is just the fusion of growth. Bergeron ice, it has to do with the ice crystals breaking, and water droplets breaking. And stuff. This is just a diffusional growth of single crystals.
Okay.
So we're trying to start simple here, just with the idea that water will diffuse away from the liquids and into the ice particles. So we'll see that. I mean, once you get some ice to form, it will take a lot of the vapor and deplete the ice and deplete the water. So ice crystals grow rapidly. That means quite fast compared to the water. And the water vapor, the water droplets can evaporate because you're losing some of that vapor around the surface. So more of it's going to go from the droplet to the vapor phase. Or the gas phase. Large fraction ice crystals tend to fall stellar types. You can get a large number of crates of the crystals. So you can get different habits. That form. Stellars are like the dendrites in the 15, minus 15 degree range. So if you can, the idea here is if you could take that super cooled water, minus 12, minus 15, create some stellar type of dendrite type of crystals. These will grow big and they can fall where the water droplets would not. Okay, they get big, they'll grow where the water droplets will not. The water is limited to 20 microns in diameter. So these can go to 100 microns and they can start to fall. So it's that change of size of the ice particles now. Fucking ice, not the aerosols. And these are a lot bigger than the original aerosols.
Stellar types and plate types are just more crystal habits.
Yeah, the crystal habits. If you go back, the stellars, so it's kind of a class of habits. Like these ones here would be the stellar, kind of star shape type of crystal.
Why is the water limited to microns?
Because if you go back to our droplet growth. Remember, we have the curvature effect. So as the droplet gets bigger, the surface areas get large. So they grow, but think of trying to add the same amount of water, but your droplet gets bigger and bigger. You can't add as much surface area. So it's limited. By how much it condenses, because it starts to condense and then other stuff starts to evaporate. So it's really the ratio between the surface area and the volume of the droplets.
And just because the ice won't have it evaporate off, you're able to get past that 25 microns.
Yeah, because the vapor pressure is different too. It's lower. So it would absorb and grow bigger. So it gets all bigger particles. Okay, because the droplets are spherical, these ice crystals don't have to be spherical either. But you have this surface to volume ratios are set with the droplets, and they get so big, they basically become an equilibrium that as much evaporates as it condenses. Okay, because it's a curvature and solubility of solution effect in there. But they just grow very, very, very slowly. So kind of like when I say the ice crystals grow rapidly, whatever it was here, ice crystals grow rapidly, that's kind of with respect to what you would compare to with the water. They go very rapidly compared to what the water droplets do. So the water droplets do grow, just not very fast. And so very fast becomes hours or days. So get to the bigger side.
So water droplets and ice crystals both grow until they hit their own equilibrium point, right?
They grow until, well, they grow until the it's equilibrium between the water and vapor phase. Between the what's, you know, so there's an equilibrium between what's evaporating and what's condensing.
So if you have a, let's say you have a summer storm one day that's at 20 degrees Celsius, and then you have one that's at minus 30. That difference in vapor pressure, is that going to make the droplets smaller on the colder storm in general?
Oh, so you're thinking of the size of the droplet. Oh, and
so the air is colder, it has less moisture can hold.
Yeah, it has so less moisture that it would hold.
Vapor pressure, right?
But The droplets don't, I'm getting mad at because it's the, if you go back to how they, I don't have the diagram, but they form on a CCN and then they activate. So then they start to form even if the supersaturation goes down. Okay. But the initial formation is a lot harder at the lower temperatures. So it's not so much the growth, it's the formation of the droplets to begin with. That would be the problem. But they tend to grow and use up the vapor. And they're changed somewhat in size, but that depends on the aerosols that they began with a little bit. But they're limited by how much that condensational process can grow. Okay, questions? Oh, I hate to wait five minutes. Maybe we can, other questions? Maybe we can quickly go through this one and then we can start again and kind of hit it twice. Give me the 5 minutes here. I'll give you a highlight to look at for next time because we've been, the next topic would be crowd types. So one of the things you want to do is identify, a lot of times when you're flying around, and that's one of the great things about atmospheric science. We're in the atmosphere, it's here. You know, it's not very microscopic, and you can't see without a microscope, and it's not a star far away where we're here, we're in the atmosphere, you can fly around it with the airplanes. And we can actually see what we're doing. And so part of this is to get you identifying what type of weather we have and the types of clouds. So at least be able to talk to the meteorologist when they tell you weather forecasting and type of stuff. So some basic cloud types, high, medium, and low clouds. These refer to how high they are in the atmosphere. So you know, maybe you can see this when you go out and fly, see where the cloud bases are. And I guess we define these as meteorologists too, as I think we have them defined in terms of kilometers. Sorry, you have to convert from your feet. So multiply by 3. So 6 kilometers, 19,000 feet. And these are, you know, 6,000 meters is a kilometer. So you should have some numbers. So high clouds above that, and they are typically composed of ice. So we talk about water and ice, and that's how we kind of identify these clouds. So before I begin, I should close to Brian. So does anybody know what clouds are out there today?
Yes.
Hey, someone knows.
White ones?
White ones? This looks like a pretty big stratus deck of clouds, right? So we know what about cumulus stratus. I do a lot of study now of cirrus clouds. So these are Cirrus. And then We have cirrus, cirrus stratus, cirrus cumerus. The stratus means layered, so big, long, large layers of the clouds. The cumerus are more individual and puffy type of clouds. These pictures don't do it good. Do you ever see these wispy clouds? I got the cirrus ones, and you see these like streaks that come down. Is that what you call them? They're like the fog streaks. They're ice particles falling out of the clouds. And you can see them a lot of times as these fog streaks. but they form and they fall very slowly. Mid-level clouds, basically can pull 2 to 6 kilometers. Convert that to your feet again. The mid-level clouds are composed of both water and ice. So you can have both of these coexist at the same levels. Mid-level, ultra-stratus, ultra-cumerus. So these are an example of the cumulus. You can see the little puffiness in them, the individual cells, where this is this whole deck of the part of the sky is covered. It's a big layer of clouds. Low-level clouds composed of mostly water. And so you see the rainbow effects here. So there are some hints when you see rainbows like that, it has to be a water cloud because of the way it bends the light. We see the light on the at sunset here in the wintertime. You see the sun dogs, I should have a picture of them, right? So there's ice crystals in there because they have to scatter light at a certain angle. So there's hints about that. The other thing that's important is vertical development of the clouds. You know, you can look at the base of the clouds that may be 2,000 feet and the tops may be 8,000 feet. So there's vertical development in this cloud that you can see from the distance, okay? But if you're in the clouds or going through them, you don't necessarily see that vertical extent if you're underneath that. The other thing is you can identify the liquid parts. So this is an example where you have both water and ice. So should probably do it on the, like my pointers. So here you can see these are the water parts of the cloud here. And then up here, there's misty haze like this, the ice was more towards the tops. Sometimes you can see the little ice form on the tops of the cumulus clouds, but it's that hazy, misty. I don't know if it's very misty, but it's not the puffiness. And if you have summertime and you have nothing else to do, you can just watch these columns grow, or you can look at, maybe I should bring in some time-lapse video, and you can see these turrets growing up. These are the parts of the cloud here. They would start extending because it rises from the bottom. Cumulus clouds, cumulonimbus. One of my favorite clouds, these are summertime cumulus clouds, these white puffy clouds that are individual. And they will have, you know, some vertical extent. And then the big cumulonimbus ones are the big storms where you have lots of rain, and you have these anvils that extend out for them. So the last part is that where all the super cool parts of the cloud, or the water parts, you see in here, there's water, and over here is the ice types of stuff in the clouds. So you can look at this and say, yeah, there's this water in this cloud by the visual appearance. And you can take your airplane and fly through it. And then you can see that you have that water there. And then if you put the AGI or some ice nuclei in there, you can form the ice particles. And you'll see it when you come back and develop it. But you really want to identify these because you don't want to see the cloud that already has ice in it. You want to see the ones that are still developing to put the AGI. So you want to identify where you are, where you can fly. And you get really good. You can fly out, see two developing cumulus fields, and look and see which one has more updrafts, more formation of the clouds as it's growing, how fast it grows. Okay, I got through that. Maybe we'll quickly review them next time, but let you guys go patient with all my questions and stuff. So we're gonna go in a little bit more bigger scale now. So is that an assignment you can start on? And I'll give you another one. Probably done already and got a 10% on it. So you can do it twice, only twice. So.
This morning, it was invisible at 4500 feet. Only at 4500 feet.